We're gonna get started with this conversation, eco-socialism against the market. My name is Daniel Denver. I'm the host of Jacobin's podcast, The Dig. This is not a podcast, though. It's just a normal conversation. And the person I'm gonna be conversing with is Kate Aronoff, who is a fellow at the Tite Media Center and contributing writer at The Intercept, covering climate and American politics. She is the co-editor with Michael Kazin and Peter Dreyer of We Own the Future, an anthology about democratic socialism in America. The co-author with Alyssa Battistoni, Daniel Aldana Cohen, and Theo Riofrancos of A Planet to Win, Why We Need a Green New Deal, which is coming out in October?
November.
I heard October. Okay. We're going to be competition. And the author of The New Denialism, which is all coming out between November and summer 2020. So lots of Kate Aronoff to read coming up soon. So let's start by talking about capitalism. Capitalism is obviously fueling climate change, and capitalism is an economic system, amongst other things. So I want to start by asking you, how do mainstream economists understand climate change? And how has that shaped the climate policy debate? Do economists' arguments really matter, or would government just be doing what business and fossil capital in particular wants, regardless of what they had to say?
So I feel like there's like the 1 minute version of this, there's like the 3 minute version of this, and there's like the 4 hour version of it.
I'm worried that you have the 4 hour version.
Don't look at that. So I'm gonna try to like strike somewhere in the middle so we can get to other questions, and hopefully this makes sense. In the Stone Age, I think the place I kind of want to go back to talk about this and to talk about how economists think about climate change is because economists think about climate change in ways very similar to how they think about many other things. And so to tell that basic story, I think it makes sense to go back to the sort of foundations, what we now today consider to be mainstream economics, which is a definition that has changed over time. The like whole concept of economics as like a separate thing from political economy is relatively recent. I'm not gonna get into that totally, but just to give sort of like a basic definition before getting into a little bit more of the history, I think a sort of, you know, basic and I would argue slightly deranged theory behind a lot of mainstream economics is that the market is a sort of ultimate arbiter of information, right? And so people only vote every so often, but they shop constantly. And so there's all this data that is being accumulated in this thing called the market, the sort of capital end market. And the idea behind a lot of sort of neoclassical economics, behind a lot of the theory informing neoliberalism is that that sort of collection of transactions is better than any bureaucrat, better than any individual to be able to tell us what needs to happen in the economy, and that the value of certain goods, certain services will be reflected in the price that, you know, that accumulation spits out. And so any sort of attempt by bureaucrats to, or the government, to inflict their own sort of arbitrary definitions of what's useful or what's valuable onto goods and services is a distortion, right? And so if the system is working as it should, people will, through the sort of magic of this, arrive at the proper valuation of these various things. And so that sounds a little wonky, right? And that's not actually how things work, as I think most people in this room probably know, but that comes with that sort of idea that the market is a sort of all-knowing thing, this kind of capital and market, was a conscious choice, right? And so back in 1920, 3 years after the Russian Revolution, Ludwig von Mises, who goes on to be, I think I'm mispronouncing that, because I'm not a German speaker or an Austrian speaker.
It's cool to mispronounce his name.
Yeah,
go with it.
Uh, So he goes on to be a member of the Mont Pelerin Society, which some folks might be familiar with. This is a sort of organization formation that Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek come out of. And he writes this thing 3 years after 1917, 1920, called The Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth, where he's arguing against the idea of socialist planning, being experimented by that point with this very young Soviet Union. And it's a sort of fascinating essay, but I just want to read sort of one quick clip of it. It says, only because of the fact that technical considerations can be based on profitability can we overcome the difficulty arising from the complexity of the relations between the mighty system of present-day production on the one hand, and demand and the efficiency of enterprise and economic units on the other. And can we gain the complete picture of the situation in its totality, which rational economic activity requires? And so the market becomes endowed with these sort of mythical qualities that, you know, are not terribly reflected in actual economic decision making, but that sort of write out the role of the government, write out the role of economic planning through that. And so he's responding to socialism very pointedly. And so the point he's trying to make is that the point that ends up driving a lot of the sort of what would become the biggest thinkers of neoliberalism is A, the market knows all, trust it, and B, is that as many things as possible should be on the market. So as many relationships, as many transactions as we can should be really filtered through this kind of price mechanism. And so what that means is not only should you pay for things like healthcare, but if you carry that through to its extreme, your parents should hand you an invoice when you turn 18 or whatever for goods and services rendered through your rearing. Which is, I don't know if any of them actually say that. Maybe there's like some people in that world who at some point made that argument. But it never quite gets that far, but that is, if you really take this seriously, that is kind of the point you end up at. And so, this gets kind of sidelined in the 1930s and through the 1940s by the New Deal, which I'll spend a little time talking about through the rest of this talk, and is not necessarily considered mainstream for a very, very long time. So this idea that the market sort of can control it all is not sort of dominant economic thinking through a big chunk of the 20th century, right? So the New Deal sort of establishes that there should be something like a welfare state in the United States. I'm not going to get into the sort of long history of those things in other places necessarily. And that there are some things that shouldn't be on the market, and there are some things the state should provide. And so von Mises, Milton Friedman, Friedrich Hayek are just, sort of searing for a good couple decades, just really angry, trying to sort of break down this consensus and push forward this idea that, the market rules all. There's a big sort of range of thought included with that, and I'm talking about, a very small portion of it, but I think the one that is important to understanding how they think about climate. And so, the sort of post-war consensus continues, through to the 1970s, where there are these, interlocking crises that happen at the same time, namely stagflation and the oil crisis, and they create this sort of opening for these guys. So the old Keynesian tools just are not working anymore, and here are these people who have been meeting for decades and decades, coming up with their own sort of theory of how the economy should work, and really thinking through in a very serious and rigorous ways what it would look like to operationalize that. And so, this history, again, I think to many of you is probably not sort of groundbreaking. And from there, we got a very bloody coup in Chile, installing a dictatorship. The CIA funds a bunch of economists from Chile to come up and learn at the University of Chicago, who then go and run the economy in Chile. And a few years later, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan take power in the UK and the US. There's a fun and probably slightly made up story about Margaret Thatcher carrying around Hayek in her handbag and some meeting like slamming it dramatically on the table to explain her ideas. I don't think that ever really happened, but it's fun. It's a fun image.
Good times.
Yeah. in her like sort of high British posh voice. So Reagan takes power in the early 80s, starts sort of like rapidly enforcing those things, and it's not too long later that climate change enters the public consciousness, right? So in the late 80s, James Hansen gives his testimony before Congress, sort of laying out the problem, and this, you know, obviously Exxon, companies like Shell, had known about climate change for much longer before this, as investigations have shown, but it's you know, in this period, like late 80s, that climate change really starts to be sort of a big part of the public conversation. And so what that means is by the time this reaches public consciousness, all of the tools that would make objective sense to deal with this, sort of massive stringent regulation, massive public investment, these have been just taken off the table very purposefully, very systematically by the folks in the sort of Montpelier milieu, the neoliberal thought collective, as some people have called it, and replaced with this very constrained vision of the world and vision of sort of what the tools are available to deal with this problem. Naomi Klein has called this a case of historically bad timing, which I think is very apt. And so what this means is that, so we have this massive problem, and both Republican and Democratic policymakers by this point have this incredibly limited tool set to deal with this. And they start to relate to climate change as a market failure. And so what this means is that, you know, as I mentioned before, that there are not enough goods being put on the market and properly commodified. And so the answer to that is to render more things on the market. And so if you look at the sort of history of things like the Pigouvian tax, which is, the carbon tax is sort of a type of Pigouvian tax. The classic example that Pigou gives in the book where he lays this out is pollution, is like environmental pollution. And that you know, you will have a factory that is putting a pollutant into the atmosphere, but the factory owners are not you know, going around and distributing a sort of compensation to the various, you know, townspeople who are breathing that in. And so Milton Friedman, you know, in the 1970s, asked a question about pollution in this sort of public forum, says we should have, you know, not, he doesn't call it a carbon tax because it's not that moment yet, but a tax on pollution, essentially.
A price on externalities.
A price on externalities, right. Yes, that was the thing I should have circled in my notes. Right, so it's this concept of an externality that there are, yeah, these things that are not being properly priced, and so you bring them into the market, you give them a price, and that sort of corrects this distortion which has occurred. And that becomes this axis around which all this change happens. So investment decisions change, people stop buying polluting cars and they start buying electric cars. Companies like Exxon stop producing fossil fuels, start producing solar panels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's this, you know, little shift that just creates this enormous amount of change. It's a very compelling theory. I think it's you know, mostly false. There's a grain of truth to it. But that as sort of a driving factor of change, as you know, I'll talk about in a bit, is not, I think, you know, terribly in touch with the reality that has become more and more clear from climate scientists and from the sort of increasing evidence of how fast we need to change things. And market mechanisms on their own are not terribly effective at getting things done very quickly. But this idea, the idea that the carbon price is the sort of ultimate fix. This drives the field of environmental economics for a very long time and becomes the sort of dominant way that not just environmental economists, sort of mainstream economists more generally start to think about this problem. And so, you know, you have people now, in the last year, people like former Fed Chair Janet Yellen, conservative economists like Greg Mankiw, sort of saying that a carbon tax, contra the Green New Deal, is the most efficient way to deal with the climate crisis. And you know, they don't necessarily get this far, but if you do, you know, carry this idea that climate change is a market failure, that a carbon price is the ultimate mechanism to deal with this, through to its kind of logical conclusion, through to, you know, what this looks like, how this plays out, you know, 10, 15, 20, 50 years down the line, you reach some pretty insane conclusion. So there's an economist, William Nordhaus, who won the Nobel Prize in economics, or you know what is colloquially known as the Nobel Prize in economics in 2018. He is one of sort of the pioneering environmental economists who has done a lot of the modeling that informs sort of what price should be put on carbon, balancing concerns for GDP growth with climate action. And one of his models, which is widely used in the IPCC, has been used by the White House, he finds that if the world were to warm by 19 degrees Celsius, a point at which there is arguably not life on Earth, GDP will drop by 50%. I don't know who's organizing GDP, who's collecting sort of economic accounting. Maybe the phytoplankton will evolve, but I'm not that hopeful.
A quick question: how high, based on what scientists have to determine we need to cut carbon emissions by to keep warming below X degree, like how high would a carbon tax have to be for that to work?
Yeah, this is the funny thing about the sort of argument that a carbon tax is this bipartisan solution.
That's super realistic as compared to the crazy Green New Deal.
Exactly, is that the IPCC, I think, predicts anywhere between like $150 and $5,000 per ton of carbon dioxide is the price that would be needed to do this. And in the IPCC, to be fair, a carbon tax, as they frame it, is kind of a proxy for, $5,000 can mean, $5,000 effectively means you just ban fossil fuels. But the idea that, by all means, if you can pass a $5,000 carbon tax, sure, I don't know, yeah, do it. I'm not convinced that's a more realistic solution than the Green New Deal. But that is sort of the argument that's had about it. So you ask, do these arguments really matter? And I think they do, not because economists know a terrible amount about the climate crisis, but because they are sort of influential. The interesting wrinkle in this is that there has been this conversation playing out within environmental economics for a very long time, and it's been mostly eclipsed by the fact that the fossil fuel industry has poured billions of dollars into denying the fact that the climate crisis exists at all in the United States. And so there's this whole sort of conversation among academic economists that sort of trickles into some policymaking spheres, but for the past several years, a sort of dominant edge of climate conversation has been the main question that it revolves around in the United States is climate change real or not? Which is entirely to the credit of the millions of dollars Exxon, BP, Shell, through groups like the American Petroleum Institute have just taken it, just dragging the conversation into the gutter. And so we're now at a point where these arguments are starting to rear their head again because the left has pushed the conversation into the realm of reality in some ways, into actually sort of reckoning with what the IPCC is saying, reckoning with what actually needs to be done in the next decade or so. And so I think, while this specific conversation about the carbon tax has not been at the sort of front of climate policy making beyond, very small rooms for a long time, I do think there is a real, a very real chance in the next several years, maybe even sooner, that we see this kind of thinking legitimated by economists and sort of pushed, as it already is being, by the fossil fuel industry, for a carbon tax and for a couple sort of token investments in things like R&D, private sector investments in renewable energy, that this will kind of become a more mainstream part of the conversation than it has been.
And so we've covered that the policy, it's bad on a policy level, but the politics of it are also incredibly bad. It's a totally bloodless call to action to confront global warming.
Yeah, and I should preface this by saying, I don't think a carbon tax is a bad idea. I think it makes a lot of sense, and we probably need something like a carbon tax, whatever we want to call it, at some point down the line. It can drive investment decisions, it will actually, it does actually change behavior in some small ways, but as I'm sure folks are aware, the kind of yellow vest movement in France which is very complicated, you know, lots to sort of think about there, but sort of shows what happens when you have kind of a neoliberal government, which is enforcing austerity, which is, you know, driving down standards of living, just saying, you know, pretty transparently, you all should bring down your emissions, and Total, one of the biggest energy companies in France, will pay no tax for all this time. And the revenue in the French budget that the diesel tax was eventually ditched was supposed to fill was almost exactly the same size as a tax cut for the wealthy that Macron's government had passed shortly beforehand. And that's, you know, that's just obvious to people, right? It's like, this is unfair. I am not, you know, responsible for this crisis, and I shouldn't have to pay for it. And so it's a real sort of like just narrow view of, hey, you know, who is responsible, right? It's not average commuters, it's not people who are just trying to get to work or just trying to get to school, you know, want to buy food, whatever, that, you know, the blame is being shifted away from the people who are really responsible, and, you know, through this much more indirect mechanism of a carbon tax, rather than, you know, even considering stopping production, even considering something like a ban on fracking, or banning offshore drilling, which were just, you know, these sort of like supply side policies.
Expropriating ExxonMobil.
Or expropriating ExxonMobil, yeah, we'll get there.
So we've made it clear that the market is woefully insufficient in terms of dealing with climate change, and that we need to obliterate neoliberalism to deal with climate change. Let's talk about the debate over how to do that. There are some critics on the left of the Green New Deal who say it's too similar to the original New Deal in that it's a plan to save capitalism from itself, which is what the New Deal, original New Deal, did, instead of replacing it with something better like socialism. My question is, do we have to abolish capitalism in order to deal with the climate crisis, or is there a struggle against the climate crisis, which is, we should really emphasize, something that we needed to deal with really, really soon to avoid total catastrophe, that is simultaneously a struggle for socialism, but that doesn't require us winning all of socialism first?
Yes. I would say the latter.
Thank God.
The leading question. I would say the latter. And, you know, I think speaking as a socialist, I am very supportive of, you know, more ownership over the means of production, you know, sort of changing up kind of how we think about ownership in general. I also don't think that we are going to dismantle the fossil fuel economy, which is just the economy, and build a worker-owned alternative in its entirety within the roughly decade we have to deal with the climate crisis, right? I think that's, you know, that's a bit of a strawman argument. I don't think that anyone's actually saying that, but I think we say
it's implicit in some people's arguments. Sorry.
Wow. So I think that's, you know, the extreme of that, but I think draws out a couple of important things, right? It's that there is private capital which will be involved with the transition away from fossil fuels, right? We live in an energy system which is almost entirely private, especially in the United States, and where private capital is, you know, just ubiquitous, right? We need to leverage private investment in the kind of less depraved neoliberal version of that phrase that it's used in kind of UN spaces. But I think what does really have to go in the very short term is the idea that capitalism and the accumulation of private wealth is the ultimate goal that society is chasing, right? And so I think we have to replace capitalism as society's operating logic, even as there is still, you know, a high degree of private ownership in the economy, even as, you know, you do things like industrial policy, which throughout history has been sort of very compatible with the kind of capitalism, with a lot of private ownership. You know, I think it goes sort of in stages, right? And I think the challenge of a Green New Deal, which I really see as a sort of great grounds of contestation, is to make sure that is not sort of just that leveraging private capital, that, you know, putting solar companies to work, is as far as we get, right? And to really be constantly sort of fighting for more, to constantly be fighting, you know, in particular, I think with the fossil fuel industry and with and with, you know, utilities and such, to really think seriously about questions of ownership, which I think, you know, I'll get to this in a bit, but it's hard to imagine private ownership of the energy economy being super compatible with dealing with the climate crisis. And so I think it's, you know, entirely possible that there could be a version of a Green New Deal proposed, and in some ways there already is, that is a sort of, you know, shell of what the folks who wrote the resolution, folks who are pushing for it in all sorts of different ways, would hope it would be, that just, you know, very narrowly confronts climate policy proper, quote unquote. So, you know, just sort of building a lot of renewables, just sort of, you know, encouraging electric vehicles and things like that. And I think the real challenge is to make it, make that fight much bigger. And the fact that those sorts of proposals are on the table, that there are, you know, things like Matt Gaetz's Green Real Deal, and I don't think that's actually been. He like had this bizarre press conference and then never actually released a thing. But it did, there were some fun pictures from it. That, you know, these sorts of things will pop up, and I don't think that's like licensed to just sort of say, oh, well, this, you know, is compromised, this is not what we need it to be. No, just like fight, you know, that is, I think, where the fight is to really battle over what this ends up looking like, A, to make sure it actually happens, but B, to make sure it is everything we really need it to be.
So what does a radical Green New Deal that is big and comprehensive and radical enough to meet the climate crisis and that is simultaneously a non-reformist reform, like what does that look like? What are some of the key components?
Yeah. So I think this has been said a number of times, but I think the Green New Deal is not, you know, a sort of discrete set of policies that will be enacted in some kind of huge omnibus bill in Congress. It's a framework under which many, many policies could happen, not unlike the original New Deal, right? And so I think, you know, the sort of highest hope for any sort of Green New Deal is to essentially rewrite the social contract onto which any amount of climate change we get plays out, and to make sure that we get much less of it. And so if you think about the fact that we're already on track for about 1 degree of warming, right, imagine that just playing out in sort of the political context we have now, where we have, you know, an immigration system, for instance, that, as you talked about yesterday, there's, you know, the bipartisan consensus to cage children, whether they're with their families or whether they're not. That's the, you know, depending on who's in the White House. And so to really rethink, you know, what actually is the government's responsibility to people who are here, right? What is it that we should be providing? What is the role of the state and the economy? You know, how do we sort of negotiate that? And I think part of a radical Green New Deal is also not making the kinds of compromises that the original Green New Deal made with, you know, people like Southern Democrats who, you know, intentionally excluded Black folks from many of the programs that built the white middle class. So, you know, not creating a sort of green redlining that happened in the New Deal. And sort of just being very mindful of the fact that when we have had these big social policies, they often, you know, many, many people, many priorities end up falling through the cracks in sort of the process of those getting passed, and sort of, you know, having a set of non-negotiables that cannot be in there. And I think the folks who have been pushing for the Green New Deal with, you know, groups like the New Consensus have been very adamant about that fact, that, you know, if you put equality, if you put social justice kind of at the end of the list, that is reliably just the first thing chopped off, and it never gets returned to.
Which is tellingly precisely the establishment critics of the Green New Deal. They always are like, why, this isn't a climate policy, why does it have all this stuff about economic justice, about social justice, about racial justice in it?
Yeah, which is, it's crazy for that reason. Like, I think there's like that seems like a basic sort of, you know, moral argument, but it's also like a real sort of misunderstanding of what the climate crisis will actually do. If you think about the fact that, like, climate change is going to be the sort of foundations on which all politics in the 21st century play out, right? There is no policy bill which will be untouched by climate. And so the Green New Deal actually, you know, in ways somewhat similar to the New Deal, says, look, we have this problem, we know that only the state can solve it, with, you know, ample pressure from below, won't get passed without, you know, sort of vigorous social movements. But we need to make a lot of resources available to deal with this. And that is, you know, not just about, the New Deal was not only about sort of putting people to work. There was a whole sort of realm of programs that ended up sort of falling under the umbrella of that, which transformed in many ways the kind of built environment of this country, which transformed kind of ideas of the welfare state, and really created a kind of new a new economic order. I mean, the New Deal order being the sort of shorthand for that. And so I think that is what the Green New Deal has to do. To actually just like be able to deal with this crisis, to be able to deal with the like millions and millions of people who will be displaced from cities which will be swallowed by the sea within the next several decades. And to be able to do that in a humane way that doesn't sort of fall as it would if nothing changes on people who are already most vulnerable in society. So really thinking just holistically about the climate crisis.
And it has to include, the Green New Deal has to include stuff like how we, like transportation, for example,
right.
Because we can't just replace all of our gasoline-fueled cars with green cars. That's not enough to solve global warming. We have to transform how we move around in the world.
Right. And that's the other thing. I think there's this like really persistent myth in some sort of, you know, some kind of like right-leaning energy circles that if we just get to 100% renewables, we can, you know, keep the economy going as is and nothing else has to change. Which, you know, even looking at sort of mineral use, resource use is obviously untrue. But also just like this, it makes the problem much harder than it actually has to be. Like, why would we not actually try to reorient cities around like public transit instead of, you know, maintaining a sort of attachment to private car ownership, right? Why would we not actually just try to think through that problem in a sort of holistic way? And the reason that we wouldn't try to do that is because, you know, we have car companies that are exercise enormous political power and keep you know, policymakers from doing that in a way that is not just like sort of conniving in dark rooms, but it's because, you know, the legacy of Fordism and the fact that like it is just very, very entrenched into the way our economy operates in a way that's, you know, is just, you know, kind of deep ideology and not always by this point even just political donations.
Well, speaking of the legacy of Fordism, that's a good transition to the next question, which is that it's not just business that would have fears around, you know, the United States making many fewer automobiles every year, but workers who make automobiles. And there has been a lot of concern about what the green transition will look like for workers. Much of that obviously has been propped up by the right and leveraged by the right. But there are many people whose livelihoods do rely on oil, coal, gas, and other parts of the economy that depend on the current organization of the economy around oil, coal, and gas. Recently, a lot of people probably saw a group of unions in the AFL-CIO's building trades, I believe it was, wrote a letter attacking the Green New Deal. So the economic impacts of a green transition are very real, not only for people's lives in terms of what the transition will be like for them, but right now in terms of obstacles that we face building the political coalition that we need to fight for this just transition and win it. How should eco-socialists be navigating these debates?
Yeah, I mean, I think the, a lot of ways to answer the question. I mean, I think the biggest one is actually to just talk to the workers who are doing these jobs and be in real relationship with folks who are building pipelines, folks who are working on oil rigs, right? Because I think the way some of the dynamics around labor and environment play out at the national level is that the sort of leadership of the building trade unions will speak for their members, and those are not always the most democratic unions. And so I think it's important for, you know, a couple of reasons. A, it's just like not assuming that the leadership of, you know, unions like LIUNA, of the IBEW, are totally representative of the people who are doing the work. This is also about just like not writing stupid policy. And so, you know, I think the conversations about jobs and environment can happen in a vacuum sometimes, like, and not necessarily pay attention to the like material reality of what this work actually looked like. So take like, you know, something like pipeline jobs, for instance, which have been, you know, one of the biggest sticking points. LiUNA builds pipelines, is one of the most sort of outspoken unions and fighting everything from water protectors in Standing Rock to the Keystone pipeline to the Green New Deal. And what I think doesn't come up a lot is that LiUNA also, you know, if they build pipelines, they also build wind turbines. But the contracts and industry standards for pipeline work, as you know, I heard from workers, were negotiated at a time when labor was much stronger than it is now, when the leadership was more willing to fight for strong contracts. And so the wind contracts are much weaker. And so folks, you know, would much rather go and take a job building a pipeline because you make a lot more money, the conditions are better, you work more steady. It's just all around from what I've heard, and this is not sort of an exhaustive account, but that, you know, though it is right now just better to take a pipeline job than it is to take a wind job. And so, you know, how can the Green New Deal work with rank and file workers? You know, both to push union leadership on some of these political questions, but also to negotiate for better contracts and be sure that, you know, in pushing at the federal level for something like a Green New Deal, a stipulation of a wind company, of a solar company getting money is that those workers have the right to organize, that there are, you know, agreements put in place that establish, you know, high labor standards for those. And that, you know, and just to have a real sort of material sense for what that work is. I also think the way, just how out front the building trades unions have been in the job and environment conversation has really sort of twisted our understanding of what a green job is and what kind of just transition is about. In a sense that I still think there is this image of green jobs as being about these like big burly men hoisting wind turbines up or you know, putting solar panels on roofs and this sort of like realist, like social realist. You know, I'm picturing like the like those old WPA posters where there's like shirtless men, like
is it hot?
Yeah. Well, there will be hot men hoisting wind turbines. And there will be nurses and teachers. Also, you know, can also be hot. I'm just going to cut this off right now. All workers are hot. But the just transition is much bigger than just, you know, how do you get workers in the extractive sector into job retraining programs? It's not just about, you know, or even at all about, you know, teaching coal miners in Appalachia how to code as part so they can go get jobs in startups or whatever. And, you know, there is all of this work that's actually existing, which is already low carbon. Teaching work is low carbon, nursing is low carbon, entertainment is low carbon, fucking rock bands are low carbon. You know, there's this whole realm of activity which is, you know, already green and can be expanded through something like a federal job guarantee as part of a Green New Deal that is just, I think, kind of left out of the conversation when it's just about, you know, extractive workers who are, you know, often implicitly or explicitly sort of make the conversation about like what is the role for white male labor in this, and really excludes a whole other, you know, decent and probably the majority of the working class in the United States.
But it's not about shifting the people who've been out of the discussion into it in a way that shifts the so-called white working class out, but actually breaking down this false binary that pits them against one another.
Right, exactly.
The green transition can take care of everyone.
Everyone, yeah. It's not that work is important, it's just not the only part of the conversation.
Yeah. Last question before we go to Q&A. How are various elites planning on dealing with climate change, which is happening right now and is getting worse every day? Well, we hear about geoengineering as a solution to the problem, a techno fix that requires us to change nothing thanks to human scientific ingenuity. We also hear about scary underground bunkers and in silo, old unused like missile silos and the abandoned missile silos in the Midwest, and like how they can train the guards to shoot other people but not them, and what are the 1% cooking up, and is this future, are they planning on a future of eco-apartheid?
Yeah, such an interesting bunch. So you hear, there, every once in a while there'll be a story about like seasteading, or folks like buying up land. I think Peter Thiel bought up a bunch of land in New Zealand, right, for, you know, some purpose or another, sort of ways that elites can very literally insulate themselves from the climate crisis, you know, by buying a $1 million bunker 3 miles beneath Arizona or something. So there's that. And there is this real sort of interest in these kind of techno fixes. I read this amazing, there's an amazing op-ed in the Financial Times, I think in the last day or so, where this columnist is sort of, you know, walks through a really sort of cogent and you know, not wrong account of the climate crisis, and sort of how far we are from the transition, how much work it'll take. And the point he lands on in his sort of conclusion is that we need an army of engineers with the mindset of Winston Churchill to take over the world's governments and sort of engineer our way out of this problem.
The Winston Churchill who like imposed mass famine on Indian subjects.
Yeah. 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 So I mean, the Financial Times is my favorite publication because it's always such a nice window into the sort of mindset of the 1%. I think that draws out, you know, an interesting point, which is like, I have written a lot about geoengineering. I think it's worrying in some ways, but I think the overwhelming response of elites of the climate crisis will be to try to preserve their way of life for as long as possible while making sure that other people's way of life gets much worse. And so I think that, you know, operates in ways that are not unfamiliar to us, right? It looks like hardening borders and militarizing borders more than they are now. It looks like sort of increasing the prison industrial complex, throwing more people in jail, you know, just trying as much as they can to enforce enforce low consumption on mass numbers of people. Like, this is not, you know, so strange to folks living in Gaza, for instance. The Israeli government has put people on a diet and enforced, you know, calorie counts, essentially, for people. This is things like this are already happening in ways that, you know, are not disconnected from resource concerns. And I think that, you know, more than any of these sort of flashy techno fixes, more than the sort of bunkers even, I think that, you know, it will play out in ways that we already know what they look like, and are, you know, I think that's an argument for the Green New Deal and, you know, any climate policy just to be as expansive as possible to really take this on in a way that is really responding to the scale of this and to the scope of just how wide-ranging the impacts of the climate crisis will be.
All right, what we're going to do is...